Welcome to Madang. Today's special guest is Dr. Terrence Lester. He shares his new book, All God's Children, and Racial Solidarity, Implicit Bias, God is Justice, Critical Race Theory, and more. Please stay tuned. Theology Beer Camp is happening October 19th to the 21st, 2023 in Springfield, Missouri. It will be 3 days of craft nerfdom with your favorite God podcasts. The goal is to create a pop-up community of people who enjoy quality podcasts, and this year will be another epic theology beer camp. Please register today and use discount code MADANGGODPOD to get $25 off of registration. Fuller Theological Seminary is committed to the inclusion and empowerment of women at every level of our institution. For nearly half a century, they have welcomed women and men equally into all of their programs. As you pursue the profession and ministry to which the Lord has called you, the faculty, staff, and students of Fuller are committed to creating an environment where women thrive, not only for your benefit, but for the good of the church and the world. Visit them online today at www.fuller.edu/madang to learn more about their commitment to your calling and to apply.
One of our wonderful sponsors of today's podcast is Garrett Evangelical Theological Seminary, a progressive, spiritually centered servant seminary that seeks to form courageous leaders in the way of Jesus to cultivate communities of justice, compassion, and hope. Garrett offers degree programs in different areas of church and nonprofit leadership, including a Master of Divinity, 4 Master of Arts degrees, Master of Theological Studies, Doctor of Ministry, and a Doctor of Philosophy. If you want to take the next step in your education, you can study in person or online at Garrett. Visit garrett.edu/madang. Again, that's garrett.edu/madang.
If you're enjoying this conversation with Terrence Lester, you'll want to check out his latest book titled All God's Children, How Confronting Buried History Can Build Racial Solidarity. In this book, Terrence shares the buried history of the struggles Black people have faced against unjust systems. His honest account of what it's like to be Black in America paves the way for the church to move beyond just showing support from a distance toward loving one another in long-term solidarity, advocacy, and friendship. Order All God's Children by Terrence Lester today at ivypress.com, Amazon, or wherever books are sold.
For sponsorship inquiries, please email madangpodcast@gmail.com. This is Madang, an outdoor living room for guests to share their experiences and their work. I invite you to come in and stay for a while.
Welcome to Madang Podcast. Today's special guest is Dr. Terrence Lester, who is a minister, speaker, community activist, author, and founder of Love Beyond Walls, a not-for-profit organization focused on poverty awareness and community mobilization. He received his PhD in interdisciplinary studies from Union Institute and University. He campaigns on behalf of the poor, including Love Sinks In, which has been featured in USA Today, Black Enterprise Essence, and Reader's Digest. They have been viewed by millions of people globally on The Today Show, Good Morning America, CBS, NBC, Upworthy, and The Bright Side with Katie Couric. His books include When We Stand, I See You, and Getting Past Stuck. Today, I'm so excited to have Dr. Lester here on Madang Podcast to discuss his latest book, All God's Children. Lisa Sharon Harper writes, All God's Children is an excellent resource for small groups and churches who are tired of mere talk and want to experience the power of the actual faith to heal our world. Dr. Lester, thank you so much for taking time off your busy day to come here on Madang Podcast.
I'm really excited to be here, and thank you so much for that warm introduction.
Oh, you're welcome. I'm so glad it's published by InterVarsity Press, and I have one book with them, and actually I'm doing another book. So this is really exciting to have you on, an InterVarsity Press author. So thank you so much for taking time.
Yeah, I'm really great. Oh, so that means we are part of the IVP author family, right?
Oh, yeah. Uh-huh. Yep. And there's Facebook groups and a whole bunch of stuff. So it's wonderful to be part of it. And it just, I wish one day we can meet in person.
Yeah, I look forward to that day. So that means we're book brothers and sisters.
Yes, we
are. In the Lord, uh-huh. Right?
Yeah. So thank you so much. And I'm excited that InterVarsity Press is also sponsoring this episode. So before we get into your very interesting and important work, I wanted you to share a little bit with us about your own organization, Love Beyond Walls. You do talk about it in the book, and you share in the book that the tagline is Movement of Doers. So can you share us a little bit about your organization?
Yeah, sure. So Love Beyond Walls was actually founded in 2013. I remember vividly asking my wife and my two small children at the time if they would mind dropping me off underneath the bridge in the heart of the city of Atlanta. With the permission of my wife and family, they allowed me to live on the streets for a little over a month in hopes of bringing awareness and attention and education to the general public about what it means to be unhoused, not only in the city of Atlanta, but across the country. And so I remember them dropping me off underneath the bridge in the middle of December. It was around 10 degrees outside. And so I didn't take anything. And there I was living underneath this bridge amongst those who were unhoused, really documenting the complexities of what it actually means to be unhoused in this country. I remember walking miles and miles in the sheer cold to try to charge a cell phone. I remember being put out of shelters with some of my unhoused friends for not making it on time. We were five minutes late and were turned away. I remember having to throw donated clothing items into a fire pit because there was no firewood, right? And sometimes people have this misconception of what it actually means to be poor and unhoused. And our organization does this approach of just humanizing, bringing attention to the narratives that are oftentimes discarded or overlooked around what it means to be unhoused and poor in this country. We stand in solidarity with our unhoused neighbors in a way where we can not only get them access to resources, but most importantly, surround them with a community of people who see the very essence of who they are as people and affirm their inherent worth and value. But we also do narrative justice work, right, to make sure that the right perspectives are being held about this population, because there is this growing effort to criminalize those who are poor and unhoused in our society and culture. And so Love Beyond Walls has always been about tearing down walls, building longer tables, being about the work of belonging, and really affirming the inherent worth and value of our brothers and sisters who may find themselves without anywhere to go.
Wow. So you started the organization 2013. That's about 10 years ago. Did you go live in the streets before you started or after you started the organization?
Yeah. So that's a great question. So to actually start the organization, the first thing that I did was live on the streets. So I took my cell phone. We didn't have a building or a budget. I just wanted to go and build relationships and really understand the complexities of how it feels on the other side. Sometimes we sit aside and we listen to social and political rhetoric about what it means to be poor, but we never actually center the voices of those who are suffering from the plight, right? I often say that homelessness itself is one of the justice issues in our world where you're labeled for something that you don't have and then punished for trying to survive it, right? I've said it before that if I didn't own a car, you wouldn't call me carless, or truck, you wouldn't call me truckless. But when you don't have somewhere to go, you're labeled homeless, which is a brief period, you know, because it's something that you're going through. It's not actually your identity or who you are as a person. And so what we try to do with our organization is really center the personhood of a person and really center in on the value that that person possesses, regardless what social location we may find them in or if they have an address or not. Because, you know, no matter if a person has an address or not, they're still your neighbor, right? And so just being immersed in this environment gave us the perspective, the passion, but also the insights as to how we should stand in solidarity with those who are unhoused to help advocate and amplify their voices.
Wow, that's amazing work. So from 10 years ago, when you were on the streets for a month, are there relationships that you built that you still have?
Yeah, I still have a lot of those relationships. And, you know, the work of Love Beyond Walls itself, you know, it was born out of this idea of like, how can we be more like Jesus in the trenches, in the margins, in the places where, you know, it's often neglected and viewed in a very criminal way. And so the idea of what Love Beyond Walls represents at its core is like, how can we build relationships and really stand in solidarity with those who are overlooked or pushed to the margins of society? How can we build these types of relationships that could be long lasting, even if they're just for a season? We really value relationships. And I like to say that our work is not a conveyor belt model. Mm-hmm. We're not built on this premise that we should just throw a bunch of resources at a person and send them on their way. We are really in this work to build the types of relationships where we can see someone's life transform, be liberated, mm-hmm. and then be able to celebrate the liberation of those persons who have chosen to transition out of homelessness. I just got a text message not too long ago from a gentleman by the name of Mark, who we encountered digging in a dumpster behind our building for lunch, who went from looking for lunch in a trash can to having somewhere to stay, to getting a job, to finding himself in corporate America. And now Mark has just remarried, you know, and reunited with his children. But that is through the power of relationships. You know, sometimes we talk about crowdfunding, right? Uh-huh, everybody uh-huh. getting together yeah. to chip in to fund this project. But, you know, wow. we take the posture of crowd loving. You know, how can we bring a bunch of people together to love an individual back to wholeness and liberation?
That's amazing work, Terrence. Oh, thank you so much for sharing that. And I guess people can go online and maybe make donations or get involved with you if they are in the Atlanta area. So thank you so much about sharing your organization. I think it's so important. And you do talk about it in your book. So when I started reading your book, All God's Children, there were so many of your stories that you included. And I felt like I kind of know you now because you include so many of your stories. And I really, really appreciated you sharing your grandfather's story. So can you share with us how he has impacted your life, your work, and your ministry?
Yeah. Yeah, I remember many different talks given to me by my grandparents. But the one that you're referencing in my book is from my grandfather. His name is Carlton York. Very brilliant man. He's in his 80s. He's still alive. But I remember talking to him as early as 16 years old and him telling me about the history, his lived experience. Because I was coming up during a time where you know, Black history wasn't actually taught through my K through 12 experience. Mm-hmm. And this encounter that I had with him happened when I was asking him to help repair my car. I remember the brake booster had gone out and my mom asked me to go over to my grandparents' house. And so there it is. Granddad is about to help me with my car. And I thought he was going to fix it, right? And he tells me to go over to the toolbox and grab a tool because I was going to do the work. He was just going to tell me, right? Mm-hmm. And so I grabbed this rusty tool. Tools looked like they had been passed down from generation to generation. And I get in the car and I felt like this was like a hard task. And I tell him, I don't think I can do this. And my grandfather always had a way of turning a car or a moment into a classroom. And I remember vividly him telling me how he went to segregated schools, how he remember being violently attacked by the Ku Klux Klan and, you know, having to spend time in the hospital for almost having his life taken. I remember him telling me about the violence and the personal attacks that he experienced. But he was saying this in a way that I went through all of this suffering as a way of sacrificing so you could have opportunities. But, you know, my conversations with my grandfather really inspired me because he tells me all of these like historical things that are like right now being banned in schools right now. But these are his actually lived experiences, and they've shaped me in many different ways because it's given me this profound respect, not only for my family, but for my culture and my heritage. And, you know, it's just given me a heart to want to preserve Black history and the stories that have shaped my life and our culture's life.
Yeah, so thank you so much for sharing that. And so, you know, you share your grandfather's history, the stories, and then you go into 2008 when Obama is elected and he says, yes, we can. So that's quite a progression. And it's exciting to read that within your book. And as you share that, you also share that it's so important to understand someone's history. The better you can see their humanity. And you just mentioned also some, you know, school districts, we don't teach enough of our American history, the genocide, the enslavement, the indentured workers, you know, the war with Mexico and all that. How can we teach history better and or share it with our children and family and in our churches? Because it's not being like for Asian American, we, you know, hardly anything's taught in the school system. So what can we do that can help? Because, you know, you do emphasize that, you know, once you understand history, you understand their humanity better. So how can we do this?
Yeah. Well, I think it's a number of ways. One of the practices that I have kind of fostered within the context of my own family is having intentional discussions with my children, you know, with my wife. Sometimes we, you know, mine out historical facts that we are unaware of, and we'll discuss those things, you know, with our children. Here recently, you know, the Supreme Court struck down affirmative action as it relates to education. And so I remember, you know, one morning we were really intentional. We got up and we just started a dialogue around this topic. And so my son, who is 12, and my daughter, who is 15, they started to ask, why is there affirmative action? Like, what is this? You know, why was this needed? Uh-huh. And those types of questions, you know, they're not questions to challenge. They're questions to understand, you know, how did this all start? Where did this originate? Why was there civil rights? Why was there Jim Crow? Why were all of these things? And so it opens up this type of dialogue where we can understand, you know, how history is shaping our present moment. Yeah. But it also helps us to understand how we need to, you know, serve and better act, you know, and stand in solidarity with Black and Brown communities, right, to ensure that this history is preserved. Because, you know, the truth is, like, when we are not talking about these things, bringing awareness to these things, dialoguing about these things, there's a higher probability for those types of moments to repeat themselves, right? And so dialogue is a really, really critical aspect. Another thing too, I would say, is immersion, which, you know, I remember when I was working on my PhD, I took this class called Engaging Differences, right? And so for one of the papers that I had to write, I had to immerse myself in another culture. I couldn't write about my own history. I couldn't talk about my own history. I had to literally spend an entire semester researching, understanding the history of another people group. Mm-hmm. And what that does to you is it de-centers yourself in a way where you get a chance to see the world from that group's perspective. You can't edit, you can't tweak, you can only listen. And that listening informs how you show up in the world and stand in solidarity with another people group. But more than that, it causes you to respect the humanity, the struggle, the journey, the legacy of what that people group have to carry. And those are just two ways. I think dialogue and immersion are two critical things that we can do. Yeah.
Oh, thank you so much for sharing that and about your children with the Supreme Court. And I think those are so important for all our listeners. You know, I've young people listening and older. So thank you so much for sharing that part. Some of my work that I do, I focus on who God is, you know, how do we experience God in our lives? So in your book, I was really intrigued when you wrote that God is justice. And then you followed up and said, white evangelical spaces are quiet when injustices cause trauma, pain, and terror in Black communities. So I was like, wow, those are really meaningful. It's correct. So, you know, when you're focusing and saying that God is justice, I think many people in the pews don't think of God that way. We think of God as this white male God. Actually, the book that is going to come out with InterVarsity Press next year, I called it Whiteness, but then they changed it. As you know, publishers always, well, most of the time they change my title, and they changed it to When God Became White. So I thought, wow, it's all that. But anyway, it's kind of intriguing. But here, I really like when you're saying God is justice, because we don't think of it that way. We think of God as a white male God, kind of like a king sitting there, an emperor kind of image. And a lot of the artists have done that, and male theologians, white male European theologians have done that. So how, because I really like this, God is justice, how can we then focus, or how are you going to teach and emphasize this more in the pews, in our churches? How do you do this? Because I really like it.
Yeah. You know, when I was thinking about, thank you for sharing your brilliant work and, you know, bringing the attention to. Yeah, it is brilliant. And, you know, we have to acknowledge that, because it brings this heightened sense of awareness to the conversation that it expands our theological constructs of what God is, who God is, and how God interacts in our daily lives, right? And I think one of this actual framing of God as justice kind of arose out of my journey through Bible college and seminary. I kept wrestling with the question, you know, what does God have to say about injustice in the world, right? There's this personal God that you encounter when you frequent a church, when you worship with your fellow believers, right? You're worshiping God, but it's more individualized in most evangelical settings, right? Where it's like, You know, what can God do for me? What is God doing for my family? Where is God taking me in my life? What is God's plan for it? It's me. And then like this theological idea of God being as someone who just only responds to me becomes, you know, it kind of creates this very selfishness, self-centeredness, right, in many ways. And during my time when I was studying the Bible and in seminary, I was like, why don't we have a public theology? You know, what does God say about the injustices that happens when, you know, lawmakers write policies that literally harm the unhoused community? What does God say about how cities are designed and concentrates poverty in certain areas, right, where there are food deserts that impact the sense of well-being or the physical well-being of Black and brown people? What does God say about environmental racism, right, where there's pollution literally killing communities because, you know, corporations are polluting the air? What does God say about some of the injustices that cause harm to the people that God also loves, right? And how are we reconciling this with our faith? And so that really started to expand my ideas about God. But then I started to read theologians like Howard Thurman, who wrote Jesus and the Disinherited, where he says that Jesus identifies with those who have their back against the wall, you know, and reading scholars like James Cone, who say God is on the side of the oppressed, right? And then really looking at this idea of justice in the Bible and how justice itself is littered all throughout scripture. It's justice, right? Means right action. And then there's righteousness, which is having this right posture of heart. And so God all throughout scripture, you know, is calling us to act right and to have a right posture of heart when it comes to those that we encounter or call our neighbor.
Yeah. Yeah. And we don't focus on the justice part. And then you also talk about white justice. I don't know if you want to share a little bit about white justice or you wrote about white justice is about right action. Righteousness is about pure being of pure heart. I don't know if you want to say a bit more about white justice or not.
Yeah. I mean, when we talk about justice within itself, I think one of the things that really disheartens many people who are Black and brown that experience injustice is when those stories are not talked about in white spaces, particularly churches, right? Mm-hmm. And, you know, the absence of that causes these types of questions that make us wonder, right? Mm-hmm. How is it that we can, you know, congregate in a church and worship God on a Sunday and say, God is for all, right? God, that we give the good news. But then, you know, we don't hear about the horrible things that happens against those who are Black and brown that creates the type of oppression and things that causes people whom God loves to not be centered. And, you know, I think one of the things that churches have to really consider in this moment is how do we actually talk about God in a way that is more expansive, that actually speaks to the injustices that are causing harm to everyday people? And then not only that, how do we mobilize, right, as Jesus followers to respond to the injustices that are happening to everyday people? And I think this idea of erasure itself has not only permeated, you know, mainstream society, but it's also crept its way into the church.
Yeah, thank you so much for sharing that. And then so to continue on, you have all these really good one-liner pieces throughout your book. And then this one I really enjoyed. You said, our gospel is not a social gospel, but it is social because it involves people. And I think that is so true. We sometimes feel like, you know, people are not that important, you know, but I don't know if you want to say more or elaborate more on that. I just love it. Our gospel is not a social gospel, but it is social because it involves people.
Yeah, it's an idea that kind of connects to Methodist minister who is retired. His name is Philip Wolkman, right? And he says, perhaps not, but since justice is often taking at the narrower, more individualistic sense of giving people what they earn or deserve, the adjective social is a reminder that justice is about community, right? How do we actually think about neighbor in relationship to the whole, not just the individual? And so when I'm talking about our gospel is social, the gospel is not just for a rich person. It's not for, it's not for just a white person or a Black person or a brown person. It's not for a poor, it's for everybody. And everybody, that this everybody-ness suggests that the gospel is social. And, you know, the gospel is responding to the needs of the people who hears that good news. And if the good news is not translating or showing up in the context of love and justice, then can we really call it good news? You know, I love what Cornel West is arguing. He says, justice is what love looks like in public, right? Yeah. And that's a powerful statement. You know, it's not enough just to say, I love you, brother. I love you, sister. But we don't focus on the issues that are causing you harm. When Jesus said, love your neighbor, he's talking about loving your neighbor and the neighborhood who shaped the neighbor, right? Mm-hmm. And not only the neighborhood that shaped your neighbor, he's also talking about being concerned with the issues that that neighborhood faces.
Yeah. So in conjunction with that, you also talk about racial injustice. And, you know, that can't be solved through peace and unity and racial reconciliation, that we must use thoughtful justice, love, mercy, and solidarity. So how do we build this racial solidarity? Because I think that's a very important point that you're trying to make. And we're, you know, we do talk about racial injustice, but not so much racial solidarity. So how, you know, you're pointing it out, how do we build this racial solidarity?
Yeah, I think there's a distinction between racial reconciliation and racial justice. And I think sometimes those two things are conflated, especially white evangelical Christians primarily use racial reconciliation as a way to say we are using this term or this idea to solve the racial divides, right? And it's aimed to kind of like mend broken relationships and to create compassion and to try to build bridges. But it stops there and it anchors itself in just like forgiveness, right? But I wrestle with that. And let me tell you why. Because you can't forgive yourself out of oppression. You can't forgive yourself out of, being harmed by racism. You can't forgive yourself out of being singled out or experiencing some type of racial trauma, right? I was thinking about my Asian American brothers and sisters who still talk about what happened even here in the city of Atlanta with a mass shooting and the taking of lives. You know, I think about, you know, the racial trauma that we experience as Black people when we see images of Black and Black brothers and sisters who are violently attacked by law enforcement officers. And that's just not something that you can forgive yourself out of. Justice is needed. You know, the system is needed to change, right? And so we have to make that distinction. But when it comes to racial solidarity, what I'm arguing in the framework is, you know, solidarity means that I'm connected to you, sister. I'm connected to my brothers and sisters who are faced with all of these oppressive types of things. And firstly, I have to lament with you. Firstly, I need to listen to the hearts and cries of what is actually happening in the community And I need to open myself up in a way where I can feel that type of pain and I lament alongside you. And it just doesn't stop there because, you know, lamentation is like a biblical healthy thing to do, to cry out, to respond to injustice, to respond to the oppressive things or the burdens that we feel as believers. But it can't stop there. Then I need to listen. I need to create the type of healthy spaces where I'm in close proximity with those who have been, you know, marginalized or face some type of systemic injustice. And I need to create the type of healthy space where I'm listening without censorship, because that's the other thing that church sometimes tries to do, right? We want to listen to lamentation, but we want to hear the sound bites. We don't want to hear the full story, but we need to create this type of solidarity where we are listening to people without censorship. And then we have to decenter ourselves in a way where we're taking time to learn from other people's perspective, because solidarity work, it's also about learning from other people, but not putting the burden on them to make them teach us, but being so close in proximity where we're standing with people that we actually learn from just having the relationship with the person, the authentic person. And then we have to have this immersion, and this immersiveness causes us to take time to spend time with others and immerse ourselves in the world, as I was talking about earlier, right? Because solidarity is not saying, I love you, but I'm still at a distance. I need to be able to get proximate enough to understand your world where I can have respect for you, but I can also have respect for your perspective. And this type of solidarity creates this posture and this invitation for our hearts to not only learn, but to love our brothers and sisters, and not just on the surface level, but love their whole selves, like love everything about them, love their history, love their heritage, love what has shaped them, love even the things that they are trying to resist and stand against, right? This type of immersion is the very thing that Jesus does. He comes into our world to stand in solidarity with us, to sympathize with our earthly sufferings, our pain, our cries, everything. This is good news. This is what makes the gospel social, right? And we have to have this type of solidarity framework. And then that leads to compassion, and that leads to standing alongside others to say what must be done to change the trajectory of what has been done to my brothers and sisters who are faced with injustice. And then you use your voice, right? Mm-hmm. And we've seen it done where we only want to use our voice on social media, or we only want to use our voice for a soundbite, and then we leave it at that. But we have no relationship with the people that we say we're standing in solidarity with. And if we are calling ourselves, you know, the people of God, standing with the people of God, we've got to lament. We've got to listen. We've got to learn. We've got to immerse ourselves. We have to have empathy. We have to stand with our brothers and sisters who are faced with injustice. And then we are using our voice not to overshadow, right, but to use our voice to bring attention to the voices that have been marginalized.
Wow. I just felt like I was in church for about 10 minutes there. Thank you so much, because those are so powerful. I'm just... Wow, thank you. That there's a lot to think about there. And I feel like I should just end the podcast now, but I want to ask you a few more questions. But thank you so much for that whole discussion. I'm sure the listeners are so grateful. You know, if people are watching this on YouTube or on Facebook video, they cannot tell how big you are. But in the book, you write that you are 6'2" and 270 pounds. And you tie that in with implicit bias. So can you share with our listeners what implicit bias is? Because it happens often.
Yeah. Implicit bias are the types of biases that have been embedded through social historical framing. It's to view a group through these false ideas of what you know, a people group actually is and what they have to offer. Like, I'll never forget one time I was at this event. It was predominantly white, and I was one of the only Black people leaders there representing an organization. Here it is, I'm a person of color in the room, and afterwards, they're collecting all of these items, and there are a group of men standing around, and I was the only Black man standing around. And these guys were putting together these boxes to load our organization's truck up. And this middle-aged white woman walks over to me, and out of all of these guys, right, she cuts through people, like, you know, all in the crowd, and comes over to me because she thinks I'm the janitor. You know, that is implicit bias, because it holds this notion that a group or a person is lesser than, and that emerges from like this historical and social framing of how we have allowed these false ideas to define our behaviors and how we show up and treat people. Mm-hmm. And I'm 6'2", and I'm, you know, 270 pounds. And I can't tell you the amount of times that people have asked me things about, you know, if I played sports, or only, you know, kind of like putting me in these menial boxes because of how they have been fashioned to view Black people. And it's harmful, right? And I have Asian American friends who wrestle with the same type of stereotypes and the mistreatment and the violence. And it is harmful because, you know, you feel reduced down to an idea that is in direct opposition to who you are as a person, to your inherent worth and value that God has created you in. And it is disrespectful to the long history and heritage of the people that you emerge from.
Yeah, thank you. You know, it happens to, you know, I have African-American professor friends and his Latinx professor friends who get the same kind of this implicit bias, thinking they're waiters when, you know, they're just dining in the restaurant, et cetera, et cetera. Just recently, I was in Quebec City in a hotel. I was just dressed in a summer dress, and a white woman came to me, like walked. I was going to my room, and she said, oh, she threw her linens into the basket. And I just said, what?
Oh,
she said, wow. I put my linen in the basket. You know what? All the cleaning ladies are in uniform, and she still chased after me to tell me this. And then I said, I had the puzzled look. I could have done something worse, but anyway, then she apologized. But, you know, those things happen to us in different situations. So thank you for sharing that. I think it's so important. And then to tie that in with critical race theory, I, you know, you brought it into the book. I was so thankful for it. I think Americans in general are very confused about what this is. So if you can just share a little bit about what critical race theory is and why it's so important and why it's such a hot topic today in the US.
Yeah. Well, first of all, critical race theory is an academic theory, right? And it's a framework that actually examines how systemic racism and power structures have impacted society, mostly those who have been discriminated against in history, right? And there are many interpretations of this, and mostly this is used to analyze how racism itself operates in legal systems and institutions and everyday life. And I think one of the things that has really gone wrong, right, especially with those who are evangelicals, there has been a lot of misunderstanding, right? And there is a tendency to misinterpret what CRT entails, right? And this misunderstanding itself has led to the belief that CRT promotes division, right? Hatred, right? Reverse discrimination, all of these faulty ideas, right? And the other thing is it has led to also suppressing dialogues. We see it right now happening around the country in states like Texas, Missouri, and Florida, and others where they have used CRT as a ploy to ban books And sometimes those books contain just basic Black history, right? I'll never forget Bernice King tweeting about how a school system in the state of Texas banned her father's speeches, right? The I Have a Dream speech, you know, and other pieces of literature that contain very critical aspects of history. And I think the other thing that has gone wrong is like this overgeneralization of it, right? That many Christians kind of assume that all books discussing CRT, right, which is a post K through 12 academic theory that is used to look at power structures and racism, have flawed beliefs, right? But one example of this is Plessy versus Ferguson, right? And in this case, right, the Supreme Court, right, legal, uphill that racial segregation in public facilities, you know, was law. It was okay to be separate but equal, right? In the 1930s, the federal government here in the U.S., you know, had this law that literally banned Black people from accessing home loans, which became redlining, right? Which is a way of excluding a group of people legally from accessing equitable things that would create the type of life that we all want to enjoy, which is a whole well life, right? And so when people start to talk about CRT in relationship to this is some type of evil thing, this is some type of thing that, you know, we need to stand against, I'm like, are you reading? Like, do you read? Do you really understand that these can be like, you know, talking points to frame the mind of a group of people to really ignore the historical things that have been done against Black and Brown people in society and culture that is starting to resurface again, you know, where more harm is being caused. And what I'm arguing in the book is that, you know, as a Christian thinker, right, you know, it's the heart, it's the head, it's the whole being, right? We say, you know, we have to be thinkers as well. It's important for us to engage, you know, subjects around these types of things, because if it can give us a better lens to examine the historical racism that has existed and the racism that still exists that creates the imbalance, then why not examine that in a way so we can know how to better love our neighbors, how we can know how to better walk in justice and in love and have mercy and to love our neighbor and not run from these things to create more, you know, ignorance, right? As Dr. Cosby says, he says, Dr. Kevin Cosby, he says, there's willful ignorance and woeful ignorance. And we are seeing a lot of willful ignorance, people who are stubborn in being open enough to hear the truth that could set us free.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for all this history lesson and giving us a sermon today. You know, the critical race theory is so important, and we know that some states are having so much difficulty with this. So thank you for sharing it and writing about it in your book. Just one last question before you go. Your book is called We Are All God's Children. So how can we begin to see each other as God's children? Because I think, you know, we don't. That's why there's racism, discrimination, all these laws that were in place before to prevent Black people and people of color from becoming successful or things like that. So how can we all become God's children? Or how can we view each other as God's children? Because that's the title of your book, All God's Children.
Yeah, when I make that statement, I'm making it to say that we need to push back against the single story narrative, right? And I think you brilliantly said this earlier, that God is not a white male sitting on a throne, right, with only one story in mind. Mm-hmm. God is a mosaic, and the diversity of God is expressed in all of creation, right? And if the diversity of God is expressed in all of creation, right, then that is glorious. That is powerful. That is loving. That is just. That is kind. When I look at you, my sister, I see the image of God. You know, I see somebody who is connected to the family of God. When I look at someone who is different from me, I see the image of God. You know, and I'm saying that we need to push back against the single story narrative that you so brilliantly defined from a theological perspective of how we view God. And we all have access to the story of God and how God shows up in our individual and collective lives. And every single person needs to be honored and treasured. And not only every single person, but the history that is connected to that person.
Okay. Thank you so much, Dr. Terrence Lester. It was such a pleasure to have you on Madame Podcast to share about your work with Love Beyond Walls and your book, your newest book, All God's Children. It was such a delight to learn from you and to hear your story. I hope all the listeners will go out and read your book and use it in the churches and in other Bible study groups or faith communities. I think it's an important book. So thank you so much for coming on Madame Podcast today.
Thank you so much for having me, and I really appreciate being here.
Okay, thank you so much.
Theology Beer Camp is happening October 19th to the 21st, 2023 in Springfield, Missouri. It will be 3 days of craft nerfdom with your favorite God podcasts. The goal is to create a pop-up community of people who enjoy quality podcasts, and this year will be another epic Theology Beer Camp. Please register today and use discount code MadangGodPod to get $25 off of registration. Fuller Theological Seminary is committed to the inclusion and empowerment of women at every level of our institution. For nearly half a century, they have welcomed women and men equally into all of their programs. As you pursue the profession and ministry to which the Lord has called you, the faculty, staff, and students of Fuller are committed to creating an environment where women thrive, not only for your benefit, but for the good of the church and the world. Visit them online today at www.fuller.edu/madang to learn more about their commitment to your calling and to apply.
One of our wonderful sponsors of today's podcast is Garrett Evangelical Theological Seminary, a progressive, spiritually centered servant seminary that seeks to form courageous leaders in the way of Jesus to cultivate communities of justice, compassion, and hope. Garrett offers degree programs in different areas of church and nonprofit leadership, including a Master of Divinity, 4 Master of Arts degrees, Master of Theological Studies, Doctor of Ministry, and a Doctor of Philosophy. If you want to take the next step in your education, you can study in person or online at Garrett. Visit garrett.edu/madang. Again, that's garrett.edu/madang.
If you're enjoying this conversation with Terrence Lester, you'll want to check out his latest book titled All God's Children, How Confronting Buried History Can Build Racial Solidarity. In this book, Terrence shares the buried history of the struggles Black people have faced against unjust systems. His honest account of what it's like to be Black in America paves the way for the church to move beyond just showing support from a distance toward loving one another in long-term solidarity, advocacy, and friendship. Order All God's Children by Terrence Lester today at ivypress.com, Amazon, or wherever books are sold.
For sponsorship inquiries, please email madangpodcast@gmail.com.